Accession number 28359, Reel 3.
Roy Gibbs, Reel 3. Roy, HMS Royal Arthur, when you were there, as well as the square bashing and the drill, stuff like that, the basic seamanship, what sort of classroom work were you being taught? What subjects?
None at all, really. Only everything was practical. The seamanship was knots and small boats and semaphore and so on. So I can't remember any classroom work at all.
Oh, sorry, I thought you called yourselves classes.
Well, they called you classes,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, I see, but it wasn't...
But this was purely a name for the great number of bodies. They split them up into classes.
I understand. Right. When you were there, did you have any leave?
You weren't allowed out of the camp for a month. and then you're allowed to go ashore, because everything is naval. You know, you don't go on leave out of the camp. You go ashore, which is all something you had to get used to. Then you're allowed to go ashore, as they put it, down to Skegness Town. Well, there was nothing there except a fish and chip shop, which had a lovely little rhyme, which I've never forgotten. Small and thin, they stagger out. Fat and stout, they waddle out. All those years ago, this big sign outside the fish and chip shop. But that was really it, Joe. We were there for about 2 and a bit months. And,
so and you never got back to London to see your parents?
Oh, no leave was granted at all.
Right. So then we're coming to the stage where everybody's being allotted the next training for whatever their specialisation would be.
Yeah.
So what happens then for you?
Well, there were about 35 of us which were split off as a draft to go to HMS St Vincent in Gosport. HMS St Vincent was an old boys training school, seamen boys training school, I should say, training where they used to take in a boy entrance into the Navy. Incredible place. Terribly uncomfortable. Well, we did actually sleep in our hammocks. I think I can only remember there we were put into intensified training of radio, practical, as well as theory, buzzer, which had become very important, Morse code, increasing our speed both at sending and receiving, how to take a radio to pieces and put it back together again, fault finding, the usual amount of parade ground square bashing, which it says marching up and down. I can only remember, funnily enough, I was reminded of by one of our members who was subsequently became an admiral, a meeting the other week, and he said, "Do you remember those dreadful loos at HMS St Vincent?" Because they were boy seamen, all the loos had no door. He said, "Wasn't it bloody embarrassing? You couldn't even go to the toilet to get a bit of privacy to stop the seamen boys, you know, going and having a crafty smoke or something." The food was awful. You used to have to pick the dead weevils out of your bread. I think they're giving you training for the Navy before you ate it. And we were in two lots. There was the TAGs under training, and what they called the CW candidates, the blokes had already, aircrew blokes had already been identified for officers or commissions. And once again, the social background was very interesting, because they actually used to pipe over the tannoy, "Hands to dinner, CW candidates to lunch." Once again, the old social side came up. Very intensified training, and we were told at the end of the period there we would be half the people who passed out successfully would go to Canada for their final flying training and so on, and the other half would go to a place called Worthy Down just outside Winchester. Obviously the idea to get as many away as possible to Canada was to they could do continual training in Canada, which you couldn't do around the area of Winchester, because of continual raids. Even in Gosport, our training was continually interrupted, because it's only just across the way from Portsmouth, and so the raids all the time. We had this continual training, and at the end of it, we were sort of lined up, and read out by name, you, Canada, somebody else, worry down, and so on. About, I think of the 25 of us passed out, and about half of those were going to go to Canada, the other half were going to go to Worthy Down.
And the training gear was more intense than Morse code signalling, things that you were being trained to do as a telegraphist.
Terrific emphasis on Morse code. We had to get up, the objective was to get you up to 24 words a minute, receiving and sending, which is quite fast, really.
So technically, how was this done? What was...
Well, continually sitting in the classroom, sending or receiving. Again, you had these old boys who, most of them had served in the regular Navy before the war had been recalled to the colours. Some of them were fantastic. There's one guy that could actually send with either hand. He'd be sending with his right hand, and suddenly halfway through he'd switch to sending with his left hand.
And he was. And how was it actually, the mechanics of it? How does this work?
Well, you sit in a classroom, you've got earphones, and you've got a buzzer in front of you.
A buzzer. Sometimes
you're just receiving to bring up your receiving skills. Other times you're asked to receive and send back exercises involving buzzer.
You say a buzzer, so you actually...
A Morse key.
You press the key and it...
Did you dodge it?
Yeah, pressing the key, does that complete the circuit?
Well, it gives a sound, your dots or dashes.
It just gives a sound.
Dots or dashes, so it's a use of the Morse code, which now, of course, about a year ago became obsolete. What we didn't know then was, and there's terrible emphasis on this, but again, it was old Navy tradition, which I'll cover later on if you don't, when we get to our actual air training.
That's fine.
At the end of it, we were split into two groups. The Canadian group, which I was on, we were sent up to Dunfermline in Scotland, into some sort of hutted camp there for a couple of nights, and then put on a troop ship, a fast troop ship, to go unaccompanied, unescorted, to Canada. On board the troop ship, I recall quite well, a big bunch of German prisoners of war, a lot of RAF aircrew trainees going out to be trained in Canada, and I think there were sort of 20 TAGs that were going to Canada for training also. Unfortunately, they looked at us, they thought we were sailors. So we were put onto ship's duties, and I was given the duty of manning the two twin Browning 5s on the stern end of the ship, to man those and carry out a submarine watch. The only trouble was, not only did I know how to load them, but I didn't know how to fire them either.
And these were Browning machine guns?
Browning .5 machine guns, yeah. They're quite big, actually. Well, they were for those days. Got into terrible trouble because I gave a submarine alarm. What turned out to be a school of porpoises, and the captain wasn't very pleased with me. But it was a very quick crossing, 5 days, and bonk, we were in Halifax.
And so this was because it was a fast ship, it went by itself unescorted?
Unescorted, yeah.
So despite the threat of the U-boats?
Oh, yeah. They used to race across. The Queen Mary used to do something very similar, yeah, the famous liner. If they were fast, the theory was that they could... U-boats couldn't keep up with them.
I see.
Later on, of course, the U-boats learnt to hunt in packs and lay in wait, but this is before they actually developed that technique.
Right. So, what sort of ship was it? Was it converted?
It was, I think, it had previously been the Empress of Japan, which is quite amusing, and renamed the Empress of Scotland for the purposes of... it had been a passenger line, in other words, but... A troop ship is slightly different. They just cram everybody in regardless.
Mm-hmm. So whereabouts were you? What was your messing situation like on this ship?
I think because they assumed we were sailors, we had a very small mess. I think just on the main deck, which... and, of course, we had become used to naval discipline by then and naval messing, which is quite complicated if you don't know it. I mean, you nominate a messman, and you all take turns at the duty, and you go to the galley, or the cookhouse, whichever you like to call it, and you collect your food, and you apportion it out among yourselves. whereas you know, the RAF would just be served and they line up, they got what they were given. So we virtually had naval messing. As you sort of became promoted in the Navy, you first of all, you as your rank went higher, you had messmen that did it for you, and your situation improved. But it was a very quick run. It was, apart from this inconvenience of standing on the back end of the ship with something you didn't know what to do with, and looking out for mythical submarines that turned out to be porpoises.
Did you ask anybody to train you on these Browning machine guns?
No, they just assumed that we could, but it was an alien environment because it was a merchant navy environment, mainly RAF controlled, with German prisoners of war.
Did you come into contact at all with the prisoners of war?
Yeah, they were allowed out every day on the what we would call the forward part of the ship. One of the guys in our course had actually been to a German university and was very fluent in German. And he sort of got talking to them, and eventually a few of us used to go out and chat to them. They're all German Desert Army. Very large gentlemen, very blonde, looked extraordinarily healthy and fit. And not the sort of guys you'd pick a fight with.
So this was the first time, of all this stage where you've gone through from the war starting to now, this was the first time you'd actually come across
face to face with them, really.
With the enemy.
But I think, again, you're young and you're gauche, and it was interesting to talk to them. We didn't sort of think, oh, these dirty Germans are our enemies, you know. They were in the position where they were prisoners, and they wanted to practice their English. We wanted to practice German. We learned a few interesting German marching songs from them, actually.
When they were out exercising on deck, were they constantly under guard?
No, not really. Not an obvious guard. I think there were one or two people floating around, you know, but they were just allowed out. What they call the ship, a cable deck, which is sort of it's the front end where all the cables are for the anchors and that. They were just allowed to exercise there. They didn't seem... So apart from the fact I wouldn't like to have a fight with any of them, they're all pretty big blokes. They didn't seem that bad. So I think, you're too young to have fixed ideas. You know, the hate comes a bit later as you get older, and you've experienced a few more things.
So this was your first taste of naval life?
What do you mean, on board or...
On this ship. Of course, the Fleet Air Arm, you could have ended up being posted to a ship, yeah? Is that correct?
Not without training, no.
No, I mean, after your training...
Oh, yeah.
There was always the...
Yeah, well, we had a six or seven months extensive training period in Canada, where we found that taking radios to pieces in mid-air is not quite the same as taking them to pieces and putting them back on the ground.
Going back to that ship, did you think at all that maybe was there any period on that ship where you thought you may have made the wrong decision, and maybe the Navy wasn't for you, the Fleet Air Arm wasn't for you? I mean, were you seasick? Was the weather bad?
I was lucky. I mean, I wasn't seasick at all. I don't think any of our chaps were. You say we're doing watch on, watch off, 4 hours on, 4 hours off, standing in the freezing cold Atlantic on the back end of the ship. It all went by very, very quickly, I think. We were keen, still keen to get out to... remember, this is another big adventure. Kids who've never been out in the country, I mean, people didn't travel in those days. We were going to be in Canada for months, you know, training. It's a big adventure. Mm-hmm. I keep using that word, but things were. I think because of our age and experience, I mean, you know, or lack of experience.
So where did you dock in?
We landed at Halifax. We were taken immediately off the train. We had, by the way, been issued at St Vincent before we left. We had the usual big naval kit bag to take all our belongings, our hammock, which you had to take everywhere with you. And we'd then been issued with a kit bag containing our flying gear, which comprised of the inner flying suit, the outer flying suit, silk gloves, woolen gloves, leather gauntlets, flying helmets, fur-lined boots, and we thought, oh, what's all this like? But yeah, so one more kit bag, so we're now with two kit bags and a hammock. And they bunged us straight on a train at Halifax down to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, where we were greeted with the usual naval lorry and taken to this, what was obviously a very large aerodrome, ushered into these huts, which were beautifully built. You've never seen anything like it. They had limited experience with the Navy. Dormitories with four dormitories. They called them an H block. Dormitory, loos and showers, and dormitory. So it's like an H, with a different course in each dormitory. We were 53A course. All the Canada courses were given an A prefix. We were 53A of it. Absolutely couldn't understand. The heat was appalling. It was so hot in these huts. At that stage, we didn't know why. People tried to open the windows and very quickly got told, you don't do that sort of thing here. You're going to find it very cold. But you have beautiful showers, continuous hot water, luxury to what we'd seen of the Navy so far.
And was this because the Canadians had built them?
Yeah, the Canadians had built them. Subsequently, we learned that our half, which was called Number 2 Naval Air Gunner School, was one side of the drone, the East Camp, and the North Camp was a Royal Canadian Air Force full-time drone. I think they had Venturas, which they were doing anti-submarine patrols out into the Atlantic. So it was full-time RCF on one side, but we had RCF staff, administration, cooking, all those sort of duties, and the aircrew training was down to feed air on personnel. I don't think we'd never seen such luxury as they had. I mean, go to the mess for breakfast, you've got a choice of eggs and bacon, boiled eggs, porridge, all the milk you want, flapjacks. For kids who've been subject to rationing, which was already getting severe in the UK, this was a new world. Amazing how quickly people get change their attitudes. I can actually remember blokes after a couple of months saying, oh, not steak again for dinner. Honestly, you know, people's attitudes change so quickly.
How did you find the Canadians? Did you interact much with Canadians?
We had a number of Canadian pilots, which we got on very well with. You know,
were they training you?
Some were, yeah, they were just driving airplanes. The only problem was that obviously the UK was so short of airplanes, we actually had to train in open cockpit Swordfish, which were biplanes with open cockpits for the pilot, the observer and the air gunner. We then knew why we wanted all these flying suits and fur-lined boots, because the temperature there used to go down to 2 below zero.
And this was the fairy swordfish.
It's a fairy swordfish, yeah. They're made by two people, the string bag. Some were made by Blackburn. There was a Blackburn swordfish as well, but they were all the same.
So what was your first introduction to an aircraft?
Well, they gave us an introductory flight where you learnt that your straps were in fact a single G-string, which we used to call a G-string, which is a strap that came out from the reinforced base of the Swordfish cockpit, which you just clipped onto a hook on the back of your parachute harness, which could be very tricky if you had a Canadian pilot, as there were one or two who were a bit wild, who like to loop the loop. There's a great danger you'd just drop out and hang by your G-string.
Hang by the string, yeah.
Or some of the buggers used to like flying upside down. Again, there was a danger you'd drop out. It was freezing cold. As we got further into winter, it got so bad that the guns used to freeze up and all that, so the equipment used to freeze up. I actually saw one bloke who had frozen. They in one position, they had to carry him out of the aircraft and get him inside to warm him up. I don't know by what means, I don't know.
And this was because the Swordfish wasn't open, it didn't have a cockpit.
There's no cockpit cover at all, you're just open to the elements. Strange enough, I mean, although it was used there for training purposes, I didn't know till some time later that the Swordfish was still flying operationally until the end of the war, from things they called MAC ships, which were merchant navy ships, with just a boarded deck laid down, and they were convoy protection. And in fact, they saved a lot of the convoys, you know, from being sunk. But they, and the, you know, Swordfish is still flying operationally, at the, and it was obsolete before the war. But it wasn't the most comfortable way to start flying, but AR, you were stuck with it, you got used to it. The local Canadians were fantastic. They opened their homes to us, they took us into their houses. We were spoilt, really. It was so different from being in a naval camp, although it was a naval commander in charge of it. But everything was there to turn you out as efficient aircrew. You know, you weren't called upon to do cleaning the toilets or scrubbing the floor, all the things we'd been used to up till then. You were cosseted, everything was done for you. Your whole job was to absorb knowledge and become efficient, and to a very high standard. On Morse, you had to get a pass mark 95% and above. That is very high. Most of the subjects we used to have to take, the pass mark was 90%. Some did drop down to about 80, 85.
What sort of subjects, apart from Morse, were you being taught?
Well, still, you know, radio theory and practical.
And the practical on the radio was actually using
Basic dead reckoning navigation, which turned out to be terribly important, because so often you'd only got two of you in the aircraft. You hadn't got a navigator or an observer. Basic navigation took up quite a bit of time. Signals, of course, yeah, the cue codes and all the various codes that we were going to be called upon to use. For some peculiar reason, semaphore. I think that's part of the old naval tradition for some reason or other. Aldous lamp, of course, using Morse code and the Aldous lamp.
Tell me how an Aldous lamp works.
The lamp, you have a trigger to a lamp, and you can actually send dots and dashes from Morse code by light. So if you had a situation, mainly if you had a situation where strict WT silence, and wireless transmission was banned because it would give away the position of a ship or even a fleet or where you are, the Aldous lamp was used, because it was just between you and who you were sending it to. There's no transmission over the airwaves. It couldn't be direction phoned.
And it worked by sort of firing a beam of light in the sense that...
Instead of, sort of
dots and dashes.
Yeah, it was just firing a beam of light.
Were you, did you ever take an Aldous up in the air with you? Would you would use them to other aircraft as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you always had an Aldous lamp with you. Not so much later on when we had much more modern aircraft, but certainly in the early days of Swordfish and Albacores. The pass marks and the failure rate, because by then we'd been whittled out, the failure rate was still quite high. I think the class that I was put into eventually, it was again about 35 or 40 blokes, only 20 passed out.
And do you know where the other men went to? What?
Well, they'd be seconded back to the UK, and I suppose put under general duties. Depends on, you know, they might have been good at something else, but they were failed. We did start to, it ceased to become a big game when about six of our chaps were involved in a mid-air collision, and we realised you could die as well, even though you were under training. Subsequently, a lot of other guys, because the aircraft used to break down quite easily in that sort of climate. So we realised perhaps it was more, we stopped being adventurous schoolboys and realised we were in something that could cause you a lot of harm.
So what was the collision between?
Two aircraft.
Two Swordfish?
Yeah. Plus several crashes we had with, they just, It was so cold there at one time. I can remember, and we were going down to Yarmouth Town for an evening out, and we were issued with these funny, like lumberjacks caps, is the only way I can describe it. They had a woolly flap that pulled down over your ears because of frostbite. And the guy sitting opposite me in the lorry, which we were going down in, didn't put his cap on, and I literally saw his ears suddenly start to swell up to enormous proportions and sort of go pink and then red. And he'd actually got frostbite in his ears. So to give you an idea, that's the sort of cold it was. You were flying in these conditions, which not very pleasant, to say the least. I say the pass marks were very high.
What sort of speed did you have to get up to at Morse code?
Still 24. You had to have perfection at 24 words a minute.
24 words a minute.
Yeah. Some people obviously got up to 28, but they were the exceptions to the rule. But you had to pass out at 24, receiving and sending, at a 95% accuracy. And if you think you've only got to drop five letters, you failed. I can't say too much about the Canadian people. They were fantastic. I mean, they treated us like their own children, their own sons. I've been back since. We've been back twice. We've had reunions here. We can't do it now. We're all too old. But it's nice to see them all. They've welcomed us again. And some of them, come over here, and we've entertained them. But there's still a terrific bond between our association. Last year, the high school, the Yarmouth High School, has a concert party, which they were giving to Canadian Legion, Canadian Legions around, and they asked if they could come over to the UK. And we have our annual memorial service in May, and they'd heard about this, and could they come and perform at our annual memorial service, which they did. All these youngsters, they'd even composed a song about the TAGs, they'd researched it, they knew what we'd been there, the relationship that grew up between some of the blokes and girls that some married and went back there after the war. And then they came to lunch with us the next day. They attended the memorial service first and laid a wreath for Canada. So now we're talking about two generations later and there's still a contact, which is fantastic, really. One little amusement.
Canadian Legion being the ex-servicemen's organisation.
It's called the Canadian Legion there, Royal British Legion here. Return Servicemen's League in Australia. It's all the same thing. It's rather like the Royal British Legion, yeah. Ex-servicemen worldwide.
Going back to the subject you're learning, can you give us an example of the sort of navigational problems that you're being set and what you used to solve them?
Well, I mean, you were taught dead reckoning, which involves triangles of velocity. I don't know if I can be that technical now.
Try it.
Yeah, well, you probably know, you can't fly, well, in those days you couldn't fly from A to B because the wind would blow you off your course. So you had to plot a triangle of velocity which would allow you to give a course which would allow for where you'd been blown off, and it'd be a triangle so you could actually plot out a course. Plus, of course, using direction finding by radio to get beams and so on where you can.
So how did this work? Did the position you're flying to, it transmitted a radio signal?
Yeah, they were able to have a DF beam.
Direction
finding beam. Right. Sorry.
And what on your aircraft allowed you to pick up this?
You all need radio, and the radios, like the aircraft, are so obsolete. We had what we call the Wurlitzer, I suppose it was advanced for its time, more or less. It was a sort of a radio. You had all different coils, induction coils, you had to plug in to get various frequencies. So you could use that for direction finding as well. I really find it very difficult to remember the technicalities. Now, at the time, it was most important.
Because so as well as the so this is because your job is going to be, once you're in the aircraft, you're going to be navigating, signalling and sending and receiving signals, and air gunnery.
Yeah.
So while you're on this training out on this training airfield, you're doing your navigation, you're getting up to speed with the Morse,
mm-hmm.
And semaphore. Sorry, and then
the oldest lamp.
Bit of semaphore.
And of course, maintenance. And they started gently easing us into weapon training, which initially involved firing with a rifle, getting acquainted with the Tommy gun, the Sterling gun, easing us into weapon training. And then we moved into weapon training, which was being able to find a fault in a machine gun. The ones in the Saltfish then were called VGOs, Vickers Gas Operated Machine Guns.
Vickers Gas Operated Machine
Guns. Yeah. So you had to be able to find any stop, where you got any stoppages, put it right, be able to strip the gun down in midair, that's apart from firing it, and then it moved into defending against practice attacks. We had fighters that would come up and attack us, and again, it's a strange thing. I don't know if, again, I can put this into words, but a fighter attacking an aircraft, because you're moving forwards, the fighter will come into the attack, first of all, on what we call the beam, which is at your side. But, of course, by the time you've moved forward and he's come in, to get behind you.
Oh, so you come in sideways.
So he starts on the sideways. Because you're moving forward, he is sort of getting round behind you.
And that was easier for him to do rather than just trying to fly behind you and accelerate.
In fighter talk, it was called a curve of pursuit attack.
A curve of pursuit attack.
Yeah. Because he had got to contend with the fact that you're moving forwards.
Right.
And he's if he tried to come up straight behind you, the chance is, well, number one, he makes himself into a very big target.
I see.
That way, quite often you couldn't get your gun round that far.
Right.
Yeah, that was all changed later on in the war because we had power-operated turret and you could swing them in any direction. But they came in and on a, well, so it's called a curve pursuit behind. So we practiced this. We practiced fighter attack.
And how did you practice it? Were you firing blanks or just moving the gun around without firing it?
No, you've got a camera gun on it,
would
register how many hits you'd actually made. You would practice firing it at what is called a drogue, which is like a tent that is trailed along behind another aircraft, and you practice firing at that. It's to get you efficient at firing a gun. When you think that you're firing again in an open cockpit. The gun was attached to what was called a scarf ring, which is like a half circle ring, and you pulled the gun up, it was spring loaded, and you could move it around this ring. That's why you couldn't get, if they were coming on the side, at them very easily. But if they're dead ahead, dead behind you, you could. Well, you've got the wind to contend with, holding the gun steady in this wind, pointing it, pressing the trigger. Everything was towards making you efficient at doing these peculiar jobs that none of us have ever done before.
And in the training, this camera gun, it was basically a normal gun. The camera was attached to it, so when you pull the trigger, it would take a photograph, or was it moving film? Was it cine film? Or still
film? It would give you... They could actually tell us how many hits we'd made, so the technology, I must admit, I can't really remember.
That's okay.
But so there was another trainer, which was indoors, which is in one of the hangars, which is like a huge screen. And you would be there with, obviously, a dummy camera gun. And you'd get